Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm joined now by a brother and sister, the poet Theo Dorgan and Angela Dorgan, who is CEO of First Music Contact and a well-known figure in the arts and music world. And welcome, guys.
Thanks, Brendan.
Morning.
And thanks for coming in. And look, we asked you to come in today to talk about your brother, Pat. And Pat died in August, one day shy of his 60th birthday, I think.
Yeah, so, a couple of days, yeah.
So like a lot of families, you'll be having a first Christmas without a loved one. But I wanted to talk about Pat's life because I think we can tend to have a particular notion of what a kind of a quote successful or an important life is. What is a life that matters and what is a life that has meaning and impact? And then I read all the various obituaries and the many tributes to Pat and his impact. And it challenged all those conventional notions of what an important life is. So Theo, will we start at the start? You're the older brother. You remember Pat being born. What was the attitude back then, say even in hospitals and that, to someone being born with Down syndrome?
Hospitals, I don't know, but I do remember, and it's probably my first memory of experiencing rage, which fortunately has been rarely in my life. The doctor telling my mother not to worry, that these kids don't live very long. They don't live into their 20s. I wanted to push the man down the stairs. You know, I know he meant well. He was a good doctor. He was a good man. And he was trying to console my mother. But his automatic assumption is that this is a burden.
Yeah.
But I remember at the same time, the look on my mother's face as she looked at Pat in her arms. Pure love. Absolute unconditional love. And that was the signature of his whole life.
Mm.
Unconditional love, wherever he went.
Mm.
Given and received.
Yeah.
He was, and as you introduced Pat, and you talked very naturally there about stuff, and only at the end did you happen to mention that he had Down syndrome. And that says a lot, doesn't it? I mean, he was a man.
Yeah.
And a beautiful man.
Mm.
Angela, so Pat was your big brother.
He was.
What are your memories of him from when you were a young child?
I suppose being younger, I just, like, as Theo says, Theo was born into Pat's life. Pat was born into Theo's life. I was born into Pat. So, like, for me, Pat is the older brother that I always played with, always hung out with, got into mischief for, if I'm being honest. Like, me and Margaret and Assumpta and Stephen, like, the five smallies, like, someone would look sideways at Pat and they'd get it, like, because,
yeah.
And, you know, and that was, in my mind, our job, and it's most of my memories. Like, we grew up together at home. Our mum passed when we were young, and our dad then 8 years later. So at home in our unit, our sister Noreen took over, and she took over from when mum passed. And we just had this kind of idea of a collective, and everyone rode in, and you know, whatever we were good at doing and whatever we provided, Pat was the centre of it. As Theo said, and I think it's just, and to think of lives lived, I think Pat lived about 20 people's lives. You know, he was so successful, he was so happy, he was so ambitious, he was so flirty, he was, you know, he was an uncle, he was a brother, he was everything, and he was like 10 lives. And you know, whenever I get people saying nice things about all of us, you can really trace all of our core qualities to Pat's. You know, he was such an inspiration.
Really?
As, yeah, like, he was, his unconditional love that Theo talked about, like, it's a lot to live up to, but it's a real inspiration. Be kind. Pat was kind to everybody. And, like, whether you saw Pat 10 times a week or once a year, he had the same amount of love for you. So there was no judgment and no, and, like, I remember even thinking that as a kid, like, that Pat was just, he was the embodiment of a giggle. Do you know what I mean? He was just like, you know, he just really enjoyed life. He never, and imagine our lives where we never thought ill of anyone or were jealous or were rageful, like Theo says. Like, Pat had such a life of none of that. He had none of those burdens. And what he did with that life showed what you can do in a life without burden, I think.
I'm interested as well that all the things that were good about G, you trace it back to Pat. So, I mean, we don't want to kind of romanticise him too much now as some kind of a saint, but did he have a kind of a virtuous kind of effect on all you? Made you better people?
Well, I think he did. I absolutely think he did. And I think, I've said that to friends of mine who've had Down syndrome kids or had also Down syndrome siblings or uncles would say that their lives are better because of what that brings to your family. And I think it teaches you an empathy without teaching it to you. It's not preachy. You adapt an empathy because you have someone you care for. And I see it from all our nieces and nephews being born. The first kind of, you know, they loved Pat's face when they were born. Pat is the only arms everybody wanted to be in. And his face was so soothing for them. And then they'd get to a point where they'd play with him and run around with him until he was done with that and he'd like turn down his hearing aid and, you know, going into this other room. And then you'd see them as they mature to beyond maybe where Pat's emotional maturity was. And you could see each and every one of them know that they had a responsibility to and for and with Pat as well. So it was an amazing effect that's rippled, like, right, you know, Pat was an uncle, but he was also a granddad uncle, which is a term he worked out with his son's husband, Anthony. So he was like, Ben is your, you know, are you Ben's granddad? And he said, yeah. And he said, so I'm his granddad uncle. So he is now, he was also granddad uncle to Jack and Sadie and Ben.
Theo, what are your memories of Pat then as a kid?
You see, the thing is, by the time my mum died and then after her dad died, I was long gone out of the house. I would have been starting to detach at about 18, 19, moving out to live on my own and so on. So I'd come and visit. Mm-hmm. And whereas Angela, Sumpta, Margaret, Stephen, they were all, they were sort of a sub-family inside the family, right? So Pat was the centre of it. So I maybe stood back a little bit more from him in that sense. And what always struck me was his self-sufficiency. He was not a dependent child.
Yeah.
He had his own strong sense. He might not have been able to articulate his sense of identity, but he had it so obviously. And he related to people on a very simple, straightforward basis. If I brought some, you know, friends or a girlfriend at the time or whatever to the house, he related straight to them as I'm me, you're you. Now, how are we going to get on?
Yeah.
It wasn't mediated, and his wasn't a mediated life. And I think people who don't have experience of living with siblings or children or even neighbours' children of differing abilities, they make assumptions sometimes which are unwarranted. They forget that this person has their own subjective life. They has their own independent life. And Pat had a very strong sense of independence. He was extremely comfortable in the arms of his sisters and he adored Noreen, who reared that sub-family, if you like. But he was Pat. And if he didn't want to do something, he just didn't do it. You know, and he made it plain, you know. Never in any aggressive. I never saw him being aggressive ever, except when he was playing table tennis. He was a killer.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That was
competitive. Unless Miss Belfast 2006 was involved. Yes. You know that story.
We come to the table tennis in a minute. Mm. Can I just ask you then, I think people mightn't remember what the broader picture was like back then, so 50, 60 years ago. What were the general attitudes to people with Down syndrome like then?
So I suppose when we were, I was looking up last week, actually, just looked it up, the life expectancy for Down syndrome. So the last measurement was in 1983, the life expectancy was 25. And the current life expectancy, Pat nailed, which was 60. He was, you know, a couple of days from his 60th. And I suppose for us, I can only view that like Theo's view would be, you know, what he saw in the adults and the reaction in the adults. As kids, I just, if someone looked at Pat too long, it would annoy me. If someone would ask me what Pat wanted and I'd be like, he's right there, ask him, like, you know, like, why does he want sugar or does he want? And I'm like, ask him. He's right there. And I think, and I now looking back as an adult to the kid I was, I suppose this was normal because this was my life. This was the life that existed when I entered into it. So, but, and I think maybe people just weren't used to, you know, people with Down syndrome weren't integrated as easily and, you know, as they are now, maybe. They were, it was a very, and growing up, I do remember seeing that a lot of it, Down syndromes were hidden. And I think I want to avoid sort of painting this as all positive because, you know, we were, we had a very privileged position and all right through Pat's life and his illness, we were very privileged to be able to help him. And sometimes I think that did mum and dad have so many kids just so we could all, it took that many of us to support and elevate him, you know. But
so Pat was able to stay at home basically all his life.
Yeah, yeah.
Which probably wasn't the, case for a lot of his friends.
No.
When he went to school, and every year in Queen of Angels, which was a very good school and quite humane and imaginative in its way, every year they had an annual show, Christmas show. And it was very interesting to look at the relationships that different sets of parents had with their children.
Mm.
Some of them were very distant from their children. You know, you could almost imagine they were possibly a bit ashamed of them. And far more of them were much more graver or loving to their children. But so it's difficult to... I wouldn't risk or dare a generalisation.
Yeah.
About how people were. But I do know that, and it was probably simply by force of his personality, Pat was always treated one-to-one. You know? You just got, and now apart from his Praetorian guard of sisters who would have gone through anybody who looked sideways at him for a shortcut, he had his own way of just simply announcing, look, I'm here, talk to me.
Yeah.
You know? And so... He was, in many ways, of course, we'd naturally think of him as exceptional. But to the extent that I can stand outside it, I think the general response to children with different abilities was quite negative in the 70s. And then gradually took on a curve of improvement, obviously with exceptions. But I think the idea that a person that... No matter whether you have an ability or a disability, that you're entitled to be treated with respect as a person in your own right, I think that has improved.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think that has improved. Mm. I only ever heard of one incident, and as I say, I wasn't living at home by now. I only ever heard of one incident where some young fellow going home from school was really rude to Pat or said something cruel. And a Sumter had collected him from the bus from school, and Sumter was ferocious, 12-year-old, but she would go through you for a shortcut now if you cross Pat. But she tore her face off, and about an hour later, there's a knock at the door, and the boy is there. And what? I said, no, I'm on talk to Pat. I said, what's up, Pat? Comes on. I said, Pat, I'm sorry, I had a bad day in school today. I'm very sorry, I didn't mean that. And when I think that, I get a lump in the throat.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, a teenage boy, you know, all that hormone hell raging in his head and so on, who's had a hard time in school, probably beaten. It was the man.
Yeah.
But he had the sense to want to apologise to Pat. Not to Assumpta on his behalf, but directly to Pat. You know, I hope that kid having a good life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You were saying earlier, Theo, that Pat was very funny too, and that probably helped him in life as well, didn't it?
Well, you know, it's a case of which came first. I think he was born with a sense of humour. You know, he certainly got a sense of humour. And Noreen, who is, as Angela said, you know, reared that cohort of the family, all of us had a great sense of humour too, and I think she probably encouraged it in him. But he was the funny. He was one of the funniest men I ever met in my life.
Funny.
He loved 10-pin bowling. And I was living in Dublin, Brother Chris was here, and Pat came up and we went out to Stillorgan bowling. We gathered a gang of 13. Now, when I say he loved bowling, he particularly liked 10-pin bowling when he was winning.
Yeah.
He was a terrible loser. Oh, the histrionics if he lost. Anyway, over to the pub with us after the thing, 13, what do you have? Give me a hand. So I'm recruited to help ferry pints, right?
Yeah.
We go for the last 4 pints and he says to the barman, he's paying. And witty young Dublin barman says, yeah, I kind of thought that, yeah. So I come down and they're all congratulating Pat. Thanks for, you're welcome. And he looks at me deadpan. Up comes a hand. me change. And it was purely for divilment.
Yeah,
he bought a room for 13 people and walked out of that bar with more money in his pocket than he had coming in.
Yeah. He was no daw, as we'd say.
Oh,
in
my
Park,
God,
yeah.
He was
absolutely no daw.
Yeah,
and Angela, the sisters used to bring Pat clothes shopping as well, I believe. You'd get a very honest opinion.
I was just thinking of Pat's sense of humour, and poor Margaret was at the receiving end of it. We were in Oasis on Patrick Street, and we were, Pat, myself, and Margaret, and I think Assumpta as well, were in the changing rooms, and Margaret was trying on a pair of jeans, and she couldn't have been like more than maybe 18, 19. And she put on the jeans, and Pat just broke down laughing, like to the point where he had to sit down on the floor laughing in her face. And she was like, what? And like, she has never, I think once she bought a pair of jeans since then. Like, he was just so, like, had a brilliant sense. He would never injure, but like had no, like, no bones taking the piss out of you. Like,
and was also a good judge of partners, boyfriends,
oh God,
and girlfriends you bring home. Yeah.
Oh, he was like the gladiator. Like, it was a thumbs up or thumbs down. Pat could finish, could literally make or break a relationship.
Yeah.
Like, if they didn't impress Pat, that was it. They were done. You have a gorgeous story, Theo, about when he met Paula.
I met Paula. Yeah, I mean, and it was
this is your
man,
wife, Paula.
My wife, Paula. Yeah. And he was a great man to get into the clinch with a woman. He enjoyed a hook, no, he really did. He was difficult for it. And so Paula came to the house for the first time, and she got the big embrace. Like, this little head appears under her shoulder, and up comes the thumbs up and a big grin, you know. And he was a remarkable, actually, judge of character.
Yeah.
If somebody was pretending to be nice but was pretending, he'd spot
it. Oh, he'd see through it. Yeah.
He'd see through it. And we were making him sound like some sort of Superman. And
well, he was.
And I have to say, Brendan, he's probably the most remarkable man I met in my life.
Really?
Yes. And you know yourself, I've met quite a few people. Remarkable in the sense that I think he enjoyed every moment of his life. He enjoyed.
Isn't that an amazing thing to be able to say? Because I think a lot of people would assume that Pat's life was in some way less.
Yeah.
Or in some way,
even
he was,
worse than
wasn't
that,
less happy.
People assume a lack of feeling, a lack of empathy, a lack of thought. Now, of course, his thought was impaired, you know, compared to the norms and averages. You could say his thought was impaired. But inside the span, the scope of his own life, he was entirely his own man.
Yeah.
Now, he felt sorrows sometimes, and he would express it very clearly and directly. And, you know, so he wasn't some sort of, you know, happy-go-lucky, smiling imbecile. But he had a very sharp sense of empathy. He would graduate. If somebody was not down, you'd get a little squeeze of the hand from Pat, you know.
Mm.
But mostly what I think he had a great gift for bringing out literally the best in people.
Mm.
He certainly brought out the best in us.
But also he was like, Pat lived every corner of his life. Like, Pat was an amazing painter, quite apart from his like achievements and why he's a national figure, I think, and won medals for his country.
So tell us about that then. This is the public Pat that people knew. So he became a great athlete, champion table tennis player. How did all that come about?
So Pat, as Theo's talking about, started at Queen of the Angels and met his besties, Teddy and John Joe. And so they went there together, and then they went to Help Industries and Toker. And then after that, that became Cope. And then Cope got a new complex in Glasheen. And Cope were brilliant at, Pat went between over his time, Bay 3 and Bay 4. And they were amazing at responding to what the needs of the clients or the workers, like Pat got a wage, he went to work on a Monday, came home every day, worked Monday to Friday, and they were really encouraging about what you could do there. So there would be activities that they'd arrange, but also, you know, Pat would talk about wanting to, you know, he'd make lamps, they spotted his creative side, and then they would have PE a couple of times a week for general health and stuff. And I remember, and so then Pat, part of the PE was table tennis. So it's for your, you know, dexterity and, you know, concentration and all of that. And Terence, his gorgeous coach out there, spotted that Pat was good at it. So he was, there was leagues, there was like, there's a brilliant Down Syndrome Ireland and Special Olympics have a brilliant series. And then there's like, there's local competitions, there's Munster competitions, there's All Ireland's. And then you, like the pinnacle, like in any sport, the pinnacle is the Olympics.
Yeah, and it's and a long route list.
It is a very long route.
You know, anyone gets to go to the Special Olympics. It's a long
route. No, absolutely not. And actually Pat missed out to his, one of his besties, Teddy, in when the Special Olympics were in Ireland, and we were so hoping he'd qualify for that one, and he didn't, and he qualified for the following one, which was in Shanghai. And again, as Theo says, like, Pat was very competitive. He would fight a point with an umpire, but also he would be utterly...
He's the John McEnroe of the Special Olympics.
Like, he would let nothing go, like...
and unless the umpire was
Female. Yeah, okay. And that brought its own problems. So we...
He'd be so busy flirting with the umpire that he'd be missing points all over the table. Yeah.
And I remember we were all in Belfast for the very last qualifiers for the Shanghai Olympics, and they were doing the walkout, and Pat's match was the first in the series, and then the comes over the tannoy. We were all, there was about 10 of us up there, I think, and we were all sitting in a row. And next, the umpire or the announcer says, "And to, you know, umpire the first match, please welcome Miss Belfast 2006. We all like just face palmed going, no, he's going to be so distracted. But she was brunette, so we were safe.
Okay, all right. He had
a time. He took his training extremely seriously. He did extra hours down at the local Garda station at Watercross Road because they had a full size table. But I remember, he, as Angela says, he's notorious for arguing with umpires. And he used to exchange training tips with Sean O'Halpin. Because Sean Og played from the Pearshick, which is a club our father was one of the founders of. And I asked him one time, I said, did Sean Og give you any good advice? And he kind of looked at me under the eyebrows and said, yeah. So, okay, what? He said, zip it.
And Kamiri, he became then, after Shanghai, became kind of the face of the Special Olympics, Theo, didn't he? And
a lot of people would remember the hoardings, his face on hoardings all over the country.
Bus shelters,
and did he handle the kind of the notoriety, celebrity?
Listen, I tell you, I went down to Cork. I was living in Dublin now for a long time at this stage when he was picked for Shanghai and so on. But I went down to see him before he left. And two memories of that will always strike me. One is an actual memory of my own, and the other is a reported memory, if you like. I'm walking down Patrick Street with him, and people are coming over to me. Congratulations, Pat, you'll do us proud now over in Shanghai. Thank you, you're very kind. This kind of Episcopal response. And after two or three of these, I say to him, what are you like? I know, he says, they expect that. Right? Now, put that with, when he's leaving for Shanghai, the local school sends a bunch of girls up with flags to form an arch. The local guard station sends a guard escort to take the car down to Kent Station, you know, getting the train to Dublin. And he walks in, my sister Martina, who is an absolute hero of his life story, Martina is. Amazing. He walks in, he looks around and says, over the corner of his mouth, disgusted. No photographers. He was disgusted.
Angela, when did Pat get sick?
So his diagnosis, I suppose we started noticing, obviously we'd be aware of, with all of Pat's health issues, we'd be uber aware and we're always doing research. And we knew that, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia was a very common illness for adult men, especially with Down syndrome. And I suppose we would have been keeping an eye out on it. But the I suppose, just after COVID, 21, is when it really started to kick in, and that he would mix stuff up and get confused. And then it kind of culminated in November of 21. He had a slight stroke, and then that's when all the other issues kicked in. So we had to, you know, thicken his water and all of that. And he had a brilliant team in the Mercy. And as Theo says, like, Martina is the reason any of us have lives in Dublin, because Martina lives at home with Pat now. So, you know, there was variations of, little micro families at home during Pat's life. And I left in 96, something Anthony and their kid Shane. We and Martine and Pat and I lived at home together for a while, and Margaret. And then, so, but it's been Martine and Pat for quite a long time. And Martina is just like, she's, there aren't enough superlatives to describe what amazing person she is, what a great friendship they had. And she has brilliant instincts, always had brilliant instincts around Pat. So she was kind of preempting stuff as it happened, really. And I suppose the big shocker for us was that November, that stroke, because it meant then we had to kick in that care. And that was the beginning of our, you know, let's just, we all agreed immediately, let's keep him at home for as long as is humanly possible. And I think through the grief and through all of that, I think that's what's the thing that's comforting us at the moment. We'll get to the rest of it later, I think. Yeah. But we couldn't have done more for him. And like, down to his medical team in the Mercy saying, you know, they told us 6 months in November 21. And it was so like, in terms of, if you wanted to know who Pat was and why he did it, I think, you know, some part of me thinks he held on to get us all used to the fact that he was going. And he took his time because to make it easier for us. And I think also just pure love kept him going. But yeah.
Do you know, you mentioned the word burden very early on there, Theo. And I think people might assume that all of that was a burden, God, and particularly the last few years and everything. But I'm clearly hearing that you got a lot more out of Pat than Pat got out of Ollie, Theo.
When you, if you think of, in, think in terms of burden or refusal to consider somebody a burden, when our dad died and Noreen effectively took responsibility for the five youngest kids, I mean, that was an act of heroism. And a lot of people from the outside might have thought that she'd taken on a burden. Noreen would be the first to say that. Mm. The great joy in her life was being with her sisters and her brothers as they grew up. I think it was heroic what she did. And then when Pat became very ill and the decision was made to keep him at home, then there's a whole new level of heroism.
Yeah.
Ellen, all the siblings, Martina, Noreen, Angela, Margaret, Assumpta, Jack, Christy, the whole family. They formed a kind of a network around Pat. And he was never on his own. There was always somebody there with him, minding him. He had to be fed. In the end, he had to be cleaned. He was bedridden. He was effectively not there as the Pat we knew. But what my brothers and sisters did for Pat in the closing years of his life was remarkable. And what's most remarkable to me is there was never any sense of them as a burden. I'd say, frankly, much more detached. I had a different life in Dublin and it was hard for me. But up and down on the train, Angela and Margaret and Kay, up and down on the train, Chris, Jack, Martina, Noreen, Sumpta, in and out the house. The whole time, it was this kind of a network of support, like, you know, like a giant hand holding him up. And he was cradled in love all the way to the end. And I really, the more I think of it, Brendan, the more it makes a particular sense of what I've always felt is that the natural state of humanity is cooperation and kindness, not antagonism and selfishness. That's the natural state for people when they are not oppressed by the world outside. And we've been very fortunate in that all of my brothers and sisters are quite independent-minded and made choices. But the choice to love Pat was effortless. And the way they demonstrated that still fills me with kind of awe, to be quite honest.
Okay. So we go back to where we started. What is a successful life? What's an important life? What's a life that matters and that has impact and meaning and everything else there? And I think we have our answer there. And look, guys, it'll be a very different Christmas for the Dorgans this year without Pat, I know, but please wish all the rest of the Dorgans a very happy Christmas, most, and indeed to all families who are grieving this Christmas. It's not easy.
I think, Brendan, it would be fair to say we'll never be without Pat. We'll never be without him.
Yeah.
It's gone too deep for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Theo Durgan and Angela Durgan. Thank you so much for doing that. Thank you.